the Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Great to have your company on this Friday. I want to hear from you today because we're talking about female representation in agriculture. From the breakdown of why there's a lack of women who are executives, CEOs and on boards, to what women bring to these roles and how to attract more women into these top jobs. To pique your interest, here's Fiona Simpson's take on the state of play.
Very poor numbers when we're talking about executives of females in representative roles or executive ranks in agribusiness. Much like other industries, as you say, but agriculture particularly has a really poor record when you think that we start at pretty much 50-50 at the farm gate.
The president of the National Farmers Federation, and she has been for the last 7 years, but I want to hear from you on this point. Our text line, 0487 993 222, that's 0487 993 222, especially on the idea of attracting women to these jobs. Do we need quotas or targets? Is that what's needed to get better representation? Also today we're going to delve into seaweed production because like there's good cropping country and good grazing country on land, we're going to ask the question, what's the available area for seaweed production and what can it be used for? But first today, women play a vital role across all sectors of agriculture. But when it comes to their representation on boards of peak industry groups, they're still in the minority. And it's got nothing to do with the numbers of women who are entering the industry, as Alice Marshall reports.
It's a sight you're probably familiar with, whether you recognise it or not. A shot of a group of agricultural board members, with the numbers of men far outweighing those of women. And it's something that confuses Professor Jim Prattley of Charles Sturt University's School of Agriculture, because for the past 20 years, he's seen significantly more women moving through ag degrees at university than their male counterparts.
Yeah, well, we can go back to, pre-1970s when women weren't allowed in ag colleges or in ag high schools. And we've moved on a long way from there to about 2003 when women became the majority of students in our agriculture programs across the university sector in Australia in agriculture. That's 20 years of more females coming into agriculture at the professional level than, you know, we'd seen in a whole lifetime before. So if you have a look at some of the individual courses, then we know that in agriculture there's a majority, but in the animal science, animal production courses, there is a big majority of females, and so the cattle industry would be depending on a lot of those graduates. We've got to get over this issue of patronising women. We've got to accept that they're actually the strength of our sector, and they're doing a magic job. And if we look at the National Farmers Federation, for example, we've got our first female president, and she has done an outstanding job of taking agriculture to places that we couldn't have dreamed of getting with a male president. And we're a much more professional sector now than we've ever been.
And what would you say to those industry bodies across Australia's ag sector that don't achieve gender diversity and that have maybe a majority men to a minority women, if they only have one or two women on their board of six or seven men? What would you say to them?
That really is not acceptable in this day and age. We need to have very good representation of men, women, older, younger, Indigenous, and perhaps even immigrants. We've got to get over this thing that we think we know it all. There's various ways of doing things, and the better input we have from a different range of people, the better decisions we'll make going forward. And that's where we've come in the last decade or two, and I'd like to see that even stronger as we go forward.
And when it comes to the boards that haven't been proactive in recruiting women and achieving genuine diversity amongst their membership, Professor Prattley says they're actually worse off because of it.
There are quite a few that haven't moved in that direction. And I just think that they're going to be forced to address that sooner rather than later, because there's a lot of scrutiny these days on boards and committees and so on, and so there should be. And I think we've moved to a point where there's no going back, and we just have to go forward, and we need to go forward, because that's both the most appropriate thing to do in order for us to get the best advice that we can.
But after serving on the board of the Cattle Council of Australia before it transitioned into the new format Cattle Australia, cattle producer from Central Australia, Gillian Fennell, says barriers still exist for women in corporate agriculture.
It's not just a fault of board nominations or whatever. There's so many barriers to women still participating at that level, because it's a huge time commitment. And unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, but it's a fact that we're still responsible for most of the childcare and those sorts of things that somehow manage to exclude us from participating at those national levels.
Despite the barriers, Ms. Fennell said women shouldn't balk when it comes to stepping into these kind of roles.
It's a big thing to overcome generations and years of ingrained unconscious sexism. And, you know, I think it's something that we have to keep working at. I just hope that this is a bit of an indication to anyone who might be interested in serving on a board that you can put your hand up and you've got the support of the membership base. We want and need people to participate who have culture in mind and want to see this industry be the best that it can possibly be. So don't be afraid. Don't be put off. We're here to support you.
Gillian Fennell, she's a cattle producer from Central Australia. Ending that report by Alice Marshall, I've had a text in a number ending in 960 with the statement, surely it's a function of how many women apply for senior, and I guess the text ends there, but those senior roles, which is a point, which is something we're going to talk about next with Fiona Simpson, someone who's been involved in agri-politics for a number of years, 12 past 12.
The Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Because she's one Australian agri-political leader, now in her seventh and final year as the president of Australia's best-known ag lobby, the National Farmers Federation. Fiona Simpson's been involved in agriculture forever and says while the number of women on boards, in CEO positions and even management positions is improving, it has a way to go. She's passionate about female leadership in ag and laments it's very much like every other ag sector around the world and faces similar challenges.
We have amazing partnerships on farms where females and males are working together out on the farms, in the business, actually building amazing Australian agricultural businesses. But for a number of different reasons, when we look at executives, when we look at ASX-listed companies, when we look at representative ranks, our 50-50 split is pretty woeful. It goes right down to single digits when we're talking about CEOs, and very, very poor numbers when we're talking about executives of females in representative roles or executive ranks in agribusiness. Much like other industries, as you say, but agriculture particularly has a really poor record when you think that we start at pretty much 50-50 at the farm gate.
Why is it so bad?
I think a number of reasons. One of them is that the culture within industry and the networks within our industry, we're a relatively small industry. And so sometimes, you know, it is who you know and whether you know. And for people who are not in the networks, who may have taken themselves out of the corporate race for a while to raise families or change careers or do something, then you sort of not in the right circle sometimes to be the person that's going to be picked for the job, no matter how good you are. And sometimes it's the way that we set up our structures of our businesses too, where they don't really suit females who might be having to juggle child minding or looking after parents or families and have other duties as well. So there's a number of reasons, but Australian agriculture isn't faring well in the diversity stakes.
And what research is there to back it up that women are needed at the table?
Look, there's a huge amount of research to show that diverse groups of people, whether they're in boards or groups, make the best decisions. And that's because you can canvass so many opportunities. So obviously, when we say diverse, we're not just meaning women. We're meaning people from all walks of life, people with all levels of experience and expertise, all ethnicities, etc. But women are an important part of that puzzle. And there's an enormous amount of research that backs that up. That's one of the reasons why when I came into the NFF role nearly 7 years ago now, we did actually look at starting and began a diversity in ag leadership program, which focused on mentoring and networking to make sure that we had the women who had the skills really confident and in touch with some of the people who were making the decisions about the roles, because we saw that that was a gap and that was what was needed to try and move the dial when it came to putting women into executive ranks and leadership positions within our industry. And it's been pleasing to see that from a very slow start, just six companies, 6 years ago, we're now well over 30 companies participating in that, and the dial and the statistics are starting to move quite significantly within that group.
That's good news. But when back to representation and what women bring to leadership roles again, and when we're talking about that generally and you talk about statistics, they're generalisations. But can you give me an example of what women bring? Say you, for instance, Fiona Simpson, what do you bring to the table?
Well, I think sometimes women bring quite a different view to others at the table. Women have often arrived in their agricultural role through a different journey. Many women who end up on farms, for example, may have come through a professional career to start with. A lot of them don't even grow up on farms or in regional areas. So they bring quite different skills and expertise to a boardroom, for example, than a bloke who's grown up on a farm, grown up in a regional area and made that his career. And neither of those are better than each other. It's just different. And that enables you to look at some of the big issues that we have in Australian agriculture from all angles. It enables you to come from much better decisions if you have those diverse groups. And as for our 2030 roadmap that we have in NFF, it's all about making our industry an industry of choice for the future, for everybody, for young people from the city, for people of all walks of life, people of all genders, people of all ethnicities. We want to be welcoming. And sometimes we just need to check how we do things in our groups and in our boardrooms to make sure that we are actually welcoming to all those different people.
Specifically to balancing gender representation, you've noted the diversity in ag leadership program. But what about something like quotas? They're known to be divisive. What are your thoughts around that in achieving that through mechanisms?
Yeah, certainly when I started in the role, I was probably opposed to quotas and targets. But now, having been in here for a while and seeing some of the barriers that are in place culturally and just in terms of how we operate as an industry, then I think now there is absolutely a real place for targets or quotas. People are scared that you're just employing women for women's sake, and I can assure you that that's just not the case. It's just sometimes that we don't look hard enough, that people are worried about going into a cultural environment where they may feel that their voice is not heard and that the proper relationships and governance are not managed. And we need to make sure that we can actually look really hard to make sure that we find the best person for the job. And oftentimes that is a woman who may not be in our regular circles and the regular places that we might look to fill those positions from.
So perhaps targets rather than quotas. But then again, you often hear women bemoaning the idea of a quota and perhaps even by extension a target. But then on the other hand, you have people saying, well, if women don't apply, we can't give them the job. They're simply not applying. Do you have any other ideas on how to encourage women to apply for these jobs, to put up their hand?
Sometimes we are our own worst enemies. We have to make sure that we're picking the right person for the job. There's no doubt about that. But I think it's part of the problem is that sometimes we're just not looking hard enough. We're not looking outside our regular networks. We're not just looking outside the regular places where we might see people that we could put forward for these jobs. And sometimes it's definitely not who you know. That right person may well be well outside outside your networks, well outside somewhere where you might look. They may not even be looking in the places where you might advertise your jobs, but those people are out there. The first year we ran the Diversity in Ag Leadership Program, we had over 400 applicants for 8 positions, and those women were extraordinarily skilled and in that mid-executive career level, all in agriculture, all looking to move up the ladder. So it is sometimes a matter of making sure that you look hard enough, making sure that you understand the value of diversity in your group or your board, and making sure that then the culture and governance around the way you operate your board or your group is something where people are going to feel valued and feel that their voice is heard. Otherwise, people seriously will just not bother applying.
Fiona Simpson, thank you so much for your time. I think that I can hear them calling you for boarding.
Pleasure. You actually can. They're just giving the boarding pass right this second. So perfect timing, Ali.
Thank you. Fiona Simpson, she is the president of the National Farmers Federation. She has been for the last 7 years. She's been involved in agriculture and agri-politics for much of her life. But I want to hear from you. It's a discussion that I feel like we should be having that is ongoing. And what are some of the solutions? Is it quotas? Is it targets? What's your view? You can text me 0487 993 222. That's 0487 993 222. Or give me a call 1300 747 222. That's 1300 747 222. I have had one text already saying surely it's a function of how many women apply for those roles. Absolutely a point, and you can't appoint them if they haven't applied. But what is holding up women from applying? Why aren't people putting their hands up for these jobs? Why aren't the women putting their hands up for these jobs? 0487 993 222 is my text line. 0487 993 222. Otherwise, 1300 747 222 if you have a view. That's our talkback line here at the Country Hour. 1300 747 222. 22 past 12.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
We welcome all views here on the Country Hour. I'm going to give that number out again, the SMS number that it is. So just your name, where you're from, and your view on why there aren't as many female leaders in the ag industry and what perhaps could lure them into those roles. 0487 993 222. That's 0487 993 222. Our talkback line for you again, 1300 747 222. That's 1300 747 222. Now, on this program, we often talk about seaweed in Australian agriculture, and the context is obviously around its ability to reduce methane emissions in cattle. But did you know that it's, of course, only one species of seaweed, Asparagopsis? A University of Queensland study has explored the future potential of seaweed farming across the globe, and it's found a lot more possibilities than for just cattle. Lucy Cooper has this report.
Often when we think about the future of sustainable agriculture production, we discuss the prospect of diminishing arable land. But what about arable ocean area for crops like seaweed? PhD candidate Scott Spilius from UQ's School of Earth and Environmental Science explored the role seaweed farming has as a tool for sustainability and its impact on the balance between land and sea.
The analysis we did showed that probably around 650 million hectares of the ocean would be suitable for seaweed farming. I mean, that's around 2% of the global ocean. A lot more of that could be, you could grow seaweed in. So we looked at 34 species, species that are commonly used these days for things like food, feed, and fuel. There's thousands of other species that we didn't look at, and that's just because there's not as much data on them. So I imagine if we looked at those, we might find that the area of ocean is even bigger. But the 2% we found that's suitable for seaweed farming could support at least one of those 34 species. And it also, those places would be suitable in the sense that you could put a seaweed farm there and wouldn't be too difficult. So these places aren't in the middle of the ocean, right? So they're near ports. They don't have really rough ocean conditions, things like that.
Mr. Spilius says seaweed has a huge potential as a critical crop, not just as a methane-reducing agent, but across the entire food and fibre industry. His study found that if you substituted 10% of human diets globally with seaweed products, the development of 110 million hectares of land for farming could be prevented.
We can use seaweed for heaps of other things. So we can obviously eat it ourselves, and so probably many people are familiar with having seaweed in their sushi, but these days people are starting to incorporate it into other foods. In the same way that we might process corn or soy, we can process seaweed to extract specific nutrients or proteins, things like that. We can feed it to animals, and we can also use it to produce biofuels, things like ethanol or biodiesel. And at the moment, there's kind of economic barriers to doing some of these things, but there's a lot of research into how we can make these processes more economic, more efficient.
Despite the huge coastal area Australia has, it's not the main seaweed-producing country. Indonesia is, and it's where the potential lies.
Indonesia has a huge seaweed industry already, and they also, in our analysis, show up as probably the top country in terms of that potential. They have the largest share of that 650 million hectares I talked about. But Australia is up there as well. So I think Australia is in the second spot, and then many other countries coming kind of after that. So Australia has a huge amount of potential as well.
Let's take a deeper dive into the Indonesian industry and meet Madeline Grist. Ms. Grist recently travelled to South Sulawesi to explore the seaweed industry, and did so with the Crawford Fund, a national support organisation for international agricultural research.
So Indonesia produces about 66% of the hydrocolloid seaweeds, which are your carrageenan and bearing seaweeds. So carrageenan is like a gelling agent product. So it's used in a lot of pharmaceuticals, and you'll find it especially in your vegan ice creams because it is substitute for gelatin. So that production is really booming. It's very much an established industry over there, whereas in Australia, it is not yet an established industry. Seaweed is definitely a very low-value crop. So in Indonesia, it's while these farmers are earning a lot more money than they would, say, fishing or with their lobster pots at the moment, because it is such an in-demand crop, they don't earn a lot for each kilo of seaweed, for the amount of labour that they have to put into it. And there is no mechanisation at the moment.
Bringing it back to Australia, Scott Spilius' study found that expanding seaweed farming could help reduce demand for terrestrial crops and reduce global agricultural greenhouse gas emissions by up to 2.6 billion tonnes of CO2 equivalent per year. But this cannot be achieved if we don't start treating seaweed as a crop just like wheat.
Certainly terrestrial crops have undergone thousands of years of domestication, and people have selected for the traits that they want. So those are the crops with the big nutritious fruits that we use today. And seaweed just hasn't received as much attention. So obviously people have been using seaweed in coastal communities for thousands of years, but we haven't. A lot of that has been kind of wild harvesting, and there has been a lot less focus on this kind of domestication. And so that's something where there's a huge amount of potential. And I think that's something that once that process starts to happen, it's going to make the seaweed industry just a lot more viable, both economically, but also from a sustainability perspective.
In terms of the future of the industry, economic roadblocks must be overcome in order to progress the industry further.
Economics of it are a barrier. The reality is the ocean is a pretty hostile environment for humans, for things that the humans make. And so there is a lot of risk with building seaweed farms and maintaining them. And that's why it's going to really be important for selecting the right areas in which to farm seaweeds, and also for, developing more resilient materials for being in the ocean. Right now there are these economic barriers, but those are going to start to go away as we develop the technologies to kind of push humanity more further out into the ocean.
That's Scott Spilius. He's a PhD candidate from the University of Queensland School of Earth Science and Environmental Science, finishing that report from Lucy Cooper. That story is online right now. If you put in ABC Rural into any search engine, it's the top story. You can read all about it right there. That's abc.net.au/rural. Now, I have had a text on the text line. We're hoping to get people to be part of this conversation, because it's a discussion that isn't new, obviously, but we're talking about balance, gender balance in agriculture, in those high positions, in those big jobs, CEO jobs, board jobs. I've had a text from Dave from the Darling Downs region who says, I'm all for women in high office, on boards, groups, etc. But he says the quota isn't the way to go. Well, I wonder what is. What do you think? 0487 993 222 is our text line. 0487 993 222. I'm not au fait with quotas in terms of the stipulation. Obviously, a quota would mean a female, but obviously they'd have to have adequate credentials to then be given the job. It's interesting around why a quota is so divisive, but I do hear that a lot, that a quota is quite divisive. So I'd love your view here on the ABC, here on the Country Hour. 0487 993 222. That's 0487 993 222. Our text line, your name and where you're from. Otherwise, give us a call. 1300 747 222. That's 1300 747 222. Coming up on the Country Hour, rain this wet season. People are encouraging dog owners to be warned and keep a lookout for pests and diseases, particularly ehrlichiosis. It's a tick-borne disease which has been found in northern Australia, set to become endemic in the north of this state after some discoveries last year. Here's Dr. Bonnie Cumming on the situation.
The unfortunate thing with ehrlichiosis is that the bacteria transmits really quickly. So it can transmit within 3 hours of the tick attaching to the dog. And so that means that, unfortunately, a lot of the newer generation chewable products that have been used for tick control aren't effective in preventing ehrlichiosis, because they can take longer to take effect on the tick than what it takes for the tick to transmit the bacteria.
Isn't that incredible? Those brown dog ticks are what you've got to look out for. We'll speak more to Dr. Bonnie Cumming about what it looks like when your dog has the tick-borne disease, ehrlichiosis, and what you can do about it. Coming up on the Country Hour now, though, Jodie Gundis has the latest in rural news. Hi, Jodes.
G'day, Ali. Australia's peak body representing farmers, the National Farmers Federation, is hopeful a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom will be finalised by the end of March. The deal has cleared Australia's Parliament, but is taking longer in the UK, where there have been concerns about cheaper Australian produce flooding the market. While the British market is relatively small and expensive to ship to, Australian farmers say they're excited about the possibilities it'll bring. And the consumer watchdog says there's more than enough gas to meet domestic supply this year amid ongoing uncertainty about the federal government's gas market intervention. Last year, the government announced it would temporarily cap gas prices in a bid to put downward pressure on surging energy bills. Since then, some gas product producers have been reluctant to sign new contracts with retailers, warning the intervention could lead to shortages and gas rationing. But ACCC Chair Gina Cass Gottlieb says there is adequate supply. There'll be more news at 1.
Thanks very much, Jodes. Just ticked over onto our text line is another text message from Bruce from Western Queensland. He says, regardless of any factor, appointment should be based on ability. If current boards are overlooking women because of culture, then the board needs replacing for not making the best appointment. If a woman decides to stay at home and be a parent, congratulations, they're fulfilling the most important role in society, currently socially undervalued. Bruce, thank you very much for your view. What's your view? 0487 993 222. Send me a text. I'd love you to be part of this conversation. It's not new. It obviously isn't. But it's something that agriculture is facing. And we want to talk about solutions. Perhaps a quota. We've talked about that. It's seen perhaps as divisive. Other people agree with the idea of a quota. What about targets? And what might be the thing that makes a woman put their hand up for one of these bigger positions, one of the top jobs? I'd love to hear from you. You can call as well, 1300 747 222. That's 1300 747 222. Let's go straight to the Bureau. Peter Clarkson is on the line. Hello, Peter. How are you?
G'day, Ali. Yeah, great, thanks. How are you?
Really well. I was looking and I thought perhaps the tropical coast had the best rain, but I think down in the far southeast, the Head Alert had 67 millimetres. Queen Mary Falls had 65 millimetres. I don't know if that was the top one. Oh, they're all bunched together. Oh, there was an 80 millimetre. Yeah, that had some big rain down there, of course. So that was the top of the state, I think, from the looks of it. Am I right there?
Yeah, that's right. All around that scenic rim, main range region. So the top full 80 millimetres at Gambrival Road. That's right.
Amazing. Although there was rain, if you look all over the state in the last 24 hours, quite a bit on that sort of tropical coast area. Of course, the sort of between Innisfail and Ingham, some rain up through there. But it wasn't just that spot. Right up to the tip, I see there's been a fairly decent fall of rain there. Horn Island had 33 millimetres. What can we expect today? Because I tell you what, it was so muggy where I was in Toowoomba last night. It was really, really hot in our house, humid. Can we expect more? What can we expect today?
Yeah, it's certainly pretty humid across the southeast. Just seeing an upper trough move through there and some showers and storms right across southern and southeastern Queensland with potential severe storms this afternoon. So that's one to look out for. But really right across eastern and northern parts of the state, a chance to see those showers and storms. Today, there's been a real pickup in weather over the North Tropical Coast, as you mentioned today, set to continue over the next several days. We will see quite scattered to widespread in part shower and storm activity as this afternoon kicks off.
I'm just looking at the radars. It's quite the patchwork quilt. I'm looking at the Emerald Composite Radar. Quite amazing. There are, right across from Emerald to Yeppoon. Then, even into the central west, there's a few spots of falls down to Surat. There looks like there's a bit of a storm there as well. And then even up, I'll jump onto another radar. So it's looking pretty scatty, but will they become a bit more organised by this afternoon?
Yeah, exactly right. So we'll see more of them becoming more scattered by this afternoon. The only real risk of those severe storms being in southern Queensland, sort of anywhere south of about... Charleville southwards, the main risk region, this arvo, but they will become a little bit more spatially covering, I guess, parts of eastern Queensland as this afternoon kicks off.
And there looks to be a bit of a storm, I guess a moderate, there's moderate rain up on the tip right now. It's just about to hit Sugar Airbase there, airport there, so and on to Weipa. So up in that far northern part as well, not those severe storms though, that's just ongoing weather?
Yeah, that's right, that's just ongoing. So similar to the kind of falls we've seen the last few days, so I wouldn't be surprised to see some falls up there in excess of 50 millimetres, but nothing too unusual from what they have seen around there, and unlikely to see any severe falls up there as well.
Well, let's gallop to the weekend, tomorrow and into Sunday. It's scattered showers and thunderstorms on Saturday, then on to scattered to widespread showers and thunderstorms for different parts. What will be the picture over the weekend, and how much rain could people see?
Yeah, so over the weekend, first Saturday, very similar to today, so focused around eastern and northern Queensland, those showers and storms with a slight risk of severe storms in the southeastern interior around Toowoomba, as well as around Mackay and the central coast. Some slow-moving, heavy storms possible there in the morning and again in the afternoon. But broadly, predominantly afternoon showers and storms right across the north, eastern and southeastern parts of the state on Saturday. And then as we head into Sunday and early next week, the focus shifting more to western parts of the state. So particularly on Monday, the western parts could see quite a decent drop of rainfall, looking at scattered to widespread falls in the 10 to 30 mil range, and definitely isolated falls over 50 millimetres possible at some locations in western and southwestern parts of the state on the Monday. And then we see that trough gradually move eastwards across the state during the week and the focus of rainfall moving with it. So moving to eastern parts of the state by mid to late week, and certainly quite a bit of rainfall possible over those parts mid to late week, depending on how the pattern pans out. Overall, just looking like quite an active week right across Queensland.
Quite incredible. I'm just looking at it on the Bureau's website in terms of forecast rain. And, yeah, it's the significant move from Monday across to Tuesday. It's all just moving, of course, to the coast. Does it intensify as it gets closer to the coast? So sort of Tuesday into Wednesday into Thursday, could we see better rain in those coastal areas?
Yeah, certainly could. It really depends on how an upper trough likely to come across mid to late week interacts with the other background conditions occurring about the east as that comes across. Looks like we might even see a potential return to monsoon or monsoon-like conditions about parts of the far north from mid to late week. So if that upper trough can tap into some of that really moist air from the north, certainly could see a significant increase in rainfall. But that's obviously a long way out yet and something that we'll be watching closely as that evolves over the next few days.
On the edges of the official forecast, I imagine. So watching that trough move west to east, of course, perhaps another burst of the monsoon, and then the Madden-Julian Oscillation tapping into that as the trio kind of factoring into how much rain this state could see. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, that's right. So as that Madden-Julian Oscillation comes around, that's typically when we do see that increase in the monsoonal westerlies and the monsoonal-like conditions over the north. Obviously, when that happens too, we have to be on close lookout for any tropical lows and potential tropical cyclones that may form as that comes across as well. So a bit for us to watch over the upcoming week.
There is indeed. Peter Clarkson, thanks so much for keeping us up to date.
No worries. Thanks, Ali.
Have a good one. Peter Clarkson, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau, 20 to 1.
The Queensland Country Hour with Ali Felton-Taylor on ABC Radio Queensland.
Well, a once rare tick-borne dog disease looks set to become endemic in a large part of Queensland and will continue to be a threat to dogs around the state, especially during the wet season. Dr. Bonnie Cummings is a vet with the Animal Management in Rural and Remote Indigenous Communities group and says ehrlichiosis has been in the NT for a number of years but will likely occur regularly across the northern half of Australia. Dr. Cumming explains, unfortunately, the tick that carries the disease thrives in our state.
This disease is transmitted by a tick called the brown dog tick. And the brown dog tick loves hot and humid climates, but it can extend down as far as the southern Queensland border. And so basically anywhere where brown dog ticks are found in the long term probably will be an at-risk region for ehrlichiosis.
And so tropical areas are seemingly the main areas, but you did say down south as well. So sort of along that coastal area, or can it go further inland?
No, it can go further inland as well. So we definitely see it in central Australia. It's sort of weather dependent, and we certainly see it more commonly after rains. But it's got quite a wide distribution. It really, basically the northern half of Australia is at risk for ehrlichiosis. It is a different tick that transmits this to the tick that most Queensland dog owners would be familiar with, which is the paralysis tick. Of course, on the east coast, we've got the paralysis tick, which is an often fatal tick for dogs because of the toxin that the tick itself carries. This is a bit different in that the brown dog tick, a different tick, transmits Ehrlichia canis, which is a bacteria, and it's that bacteria that causes ehrlichiosis and can be really a serious disease for dogs.
And different to, of course, cattle ticks, a lot of people are familiar with, and there's a tick line in Queensland. So in terms of where it's found, we've sort of covered that geographically, but what about in situ? Where is it found around a place?
So brown dog ticks are actually really well adapted to living alongside people, and that's because they really have a host preference for dogs, and of course, dogs have evolved to become domesticated and rely on people as well. So you'll often find brown dog ticks in dwellings. You know, they really like cracks in the concrete or the mortar between bricks. They can breed up by the thousands. They're very prolific breeders. And so in places where brown dog ticks are found, they're often seen in huge numbers. They're the sort of ticks that, you know, if you go to a top end place and there's lots of ticks around, you can see dogs with, you know, hundreds of ticks on a single dog.
Amazing. You just briefly mentioned before the transfer of the disease from the tick to the dog. How does that happen and how would you be able to recognise it?
Yeah, so the bacteria is transmitted when ticks move from a dog that's got the infection. They suck that bacteria up when they're drinking the blood of the dog, and then they'll move to another dog and transmit that bacteria when they attach to the new dog. The unfortunate thing with ehrlichiosis is that the bacteria transmits really quickly. So it can transmit within 3 hours of the tick attaching to the dog. And so that means that, unfortunately, a lot of the newer generation chewable products that have been used for tick control aren't effective in preventing ehrlichiosis because they can take longer to take effect on the tick than what it takes for the tick to transmit the bacteria.
I see. And we'll get to some of those preventative measures in a second. But could I talk symptoms first of all? What would you be on the lookout for? Would it be lethargy in a dog?
Yeah, definitely. So if they're just not themselves, if they're off colour, if they're not eating, you know, if there's weight loss. Unfortunately, the disease is quite a good mimic. It can have lots of different signs and symptoms. But the ones that we do see relatively commonly are lethargy, not wanting to eat, fever as well. Often they will have bleeding disorders. So they might have nosebleeds or bruising in their gums or maybe on the skin of their belly and thighs. They can also develop cloudy blue eyes. So that's an immune response to the bacteria. But as I said, the range of signs is really quite variable. So if there's any signs that your dog's just not right, the best thing to do is to speak to your vet.
Is there a consideration that it could be in the wild dog population with dingoes and perhaps, you know, we know a lot of dingoes and wild dogs are found in sort of peri-urban areas, so quite close to where your domestic pets would be. Is that a concern too?
Yeah, look, it's certainly possible. There's not been any research published at this point around whether or not dingoes are susceptible. There's not been the samples taken to know that. But based on their biology and their close relationship with domestic dogs, we would expect that dingoes could be affected by ehrlichiosis. And certainly, you know, domesticated but wild dogs that are living in peri-urban areas, those sort of places, they're certainly at risk as well. However, the brown dog tick does like to live in high density situations where there are lots of dogs. So that does help, I guess, the situation, certainly for dingoes anyway.
So Dr. Bonnie Cumming, what can owners do? What are you recommending people do?
Yeah, so the most important thing with ehrlichiosis is to use really good tick control that is effective and repels ticks from biting in the first place. So that means that we need to consider different products probably than what paralysis tick has got most dog owners thinking of. It means that you need to use things like a Seresto collar or an Advantix spot on, both of which have repellent action against the ticks. In high-risk areas, we recommend that you combine that then with a chewable as well. So you've got the repellent action that also kills ticks of the collars and the spot-ons, but then you've got that extra backup, that extra protection from things like NexGard, Bravecto, Simparica or Credelio.
So that's a multi-pronged effect really, making sure you're covering all bases.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, doing regular tick searches, a daily tick search is also really important. You know, keeping your dog nice and healthy and not taking them into areas where there's really high tick density populations as well. But really those tick control products are really essential in preventing this really awful disease.
Is there a further complication in Queensland because it's only recently been discovered here that there will be a lack of immunity because dogs haven't perhaps been exposed to this? Does it make the disease worse?
Well, we certainly saw in Western Australia and in Northern NT as the disease, following its first detections, we saw mass mortality events in a lot of communities and particularly affecting communities because of their limited access to effective tick control products. So it is a very serious disease. In some communities, we saw up to a third of the dog population succumb to this disease. We do have concerns about what it will mean for Queensland. We're hoping that the impacts won't be quite as severe. What we're seeing in the NT and places where it's been established for a couple of years now is that we are starting to move into an endemic phase, or what we think is an endemic phase, where the signs and the severity of the disease seems to be lessening at a population level. You know, individual dogs are still certainly succumbing to this disease, and particularly those that aren't being effectively treated. But the mass mortality events that we saw early on in sort of 2020 and 2021 seem to be lessening, thankfully.
That's Dr. Bonnie Cumming. She's a vet with animal management in rural and remote Indigenous communities. Check your hound for the brown dog tick and keep an eye out for the signs of ehrlichiosis. Thank you very much for your text messages here on the Country Hour. Ted from Toowoomba on the topic of balance, female representation in agriculture, says regarding quality qualified as whilst merit and capability are crucial, why not have a system where there's a male-female mix of equal representation amounting to around 70 or 80%, with the remaining being determined on need and skills regardless of gender? Thanks, Ted, for that text message. Anna from Charleville has sent a message in saying perhaps maybe a quota of female applicants instead of saying we'll hire at least one woman on a board. We'll promise to look at least 50 female applicants. That's Anna from Charleville. Thank you for your point. And S. McNamara from Glen Morgan says, forget gender equality. We need the best qualified for the position regardless of agriculture, politics or any other business organisation. Thanks for your view. I want yours if you have a view on this topic. And it's a discussion that's been ongoing for eons. 0487 993-222 is my text line, 0487 993-222, or give me a call, 1300 747 222. That's 1300 747 222.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Turning to traceability, and the Australian Table Grape Association's pilot project has received a global packing award. Using a QR code on grape packaging, consumers were able to find out more about the fruit they've purchased and where it's come from. And Perfection Fresh, based in Emerald, was one of the farms trialling the tech. The Growers Association's Taryn Milner says it also gave people in the supply chain confidence in the product too.
It's amazing, actually. We've worked so long and so hard on the pilot project. So to actually receive a packaging award just recognises the innovation that's been involved in the project. And it gives confidence to the industry moving forward to implement something like that across all the growers and exporters in the industry. We've worked with a large-scale grower-exporter called Perfection Fresh Australia, and they have farms in Robinvale and also in Emerald in Queensland. And we also worked with several other pilot partners, including Agriculture Victoria, who also provided the funding, and Result Group, who were our technology provider. And that was all backed by the global standards of GS1 Australia. So we worked really closely with all of those partners, and it was actually just such an easy, seamless path with all of them, because we're all sort of working to that common goal, and everyone was passionate about actually achieving what we set out to do.
Do you know how much fruit was exported under the traceability pilot and what markets it went to?
It went to several markets. They were both business-to-business markets and also business-to-consumer markets. I think there are around 840,000 items that were labelled as part of the project, which is no small feat.
QR codes became commonplace during the coronavirus pandemic. It was the way people checked into the places they visited. QR codes also played a key role in the traceability pilot, as Michael Dosser from the Result Group explains. His company was the technology provider for the project.
We call it a digital twin. So essentially what we're doing is we're giving every product within that comes out of a pack shed, again, in this particular case, grapes, at a unit level, whether that be a bunch bag or a clamshell of the product, gets a digital identity, the digital twin. The case of the product also gets a digital twin. So we actually know what units are with what case. And then those cases are actually allocated to pallets. They get a digital identity. And then that goes through the container and the shipment. So all of that information is actually sitting in most cases, and in this particular case, is sitting in the systems that a grower would actually have. What we did was we harvested that data. We brought it into our traceability product cloud. And then that's where all the magic takes place. And then that information is then linked back to that one QR code. So when the consumer scans it, they're directed to a microsite and they get all of the information about the product, where it's from, the region, what the variety is. You know, in the case of grapes, whether it's a green grape, we look at it as a green grape, or the consumer looks at it as a green grape. It might be a Thompson seedless. We're sharing that information with the consumer. We're also sharing with them where it came from, what farm, who the grower was, the information that sits with that. There's as much of a business-to-business story as what there is as a business-to-consumer story. You know, when an importer brings grapes into China, they sell them onto a reseller who also needs to prove the authenticity of the product. So it's all being driven from that perspective. But the big kicker is what we're seeing now is a lot of governments around the world actually starting to move towards legislating this sort of stuff. The FDA have done it out of the US. and various Asian markets are starting to move in that direction as well.
Are there plans to build on the work that was done as part of the pilot?
There won't be anything deployed this season, but seasons going forward is when deployment takes place. This can be done without turning a business upside down. What we really see important, particularly for growers, whether they be big, small or medium, is actually removing the costly barriers to entry. So they don't have to reinvent their business. They don't have to turn it upside down. We're taking the information from most 99% of cases, what they've already got to tell that traceability story. So this is a layer across the top. That is something that we're very, very proud of.
That's Michael Dosser. He's the Result Group Managing Director, ending that report by Kelly Hollingworth. What amazing tech. Well, we all know the value of TV in the bush. You can find out the weather, the cricket score, watch Landline. Well, what's happening right across the globe from the comfort of your lounge room? So what would you do if you didn't have any TV at all? Today, a small community in rural Queensland will lose its free-to-air TV coverage when the local council shuts down the town's TV transmission tower. The people of Eidsvold aren't happy about it, and they're putting up a fight, arguing their TV coverage is a vital lifeline for the community. Pat Heaney has the story.
What's on today?
Tell me what you and your husband argued about the neighbours' murder.
Every evening, Ann Johnson looks forward to a cuppa in front of the telly.
I come in 7 o'clock, home and away, and we usually watch whatever's on. You know, I don't like reality TV, you know, Big Brother and Married at First Sight and all that stuff. But, you know, it is important because it makes your brain work.
But the local council at Eidsvold, west of Bundaberg, has decided to close the town's free-to-air TV tower, meaning after today, she'll no longer be able to watch her favourite shows.
It's disgraceful. I don't know of anybody, any other place I've ever heard of that's lost TV coverage. You know, we grew up in a small town as kids, but we had TV coverage. To me, it's just part of life.
The North Burnett Regional Council CEO, Margot Stork, says the decision to close the tower was made in April 2021 after almost 15 years of operation.
And that was based on two reasons. One being the cost of continuing the service and also the change to television services over that 15-year period. And secondly, this is not core business of council to be providing retransmission services.
The closure means the 600-strong town of Eidsvold and some surrounding properties will lose access to all commercial television stations and the SBS, but will continue to receive ABC services through a separate tower. The decision has angered residents who say TV is a crucial lifeline for the isolated community. Waka Waka elder Max Chapman says the removal of the town's free-to-air TV will leave residents in limbo.
I'm an old-age pensioner. I can't go around to parties and anything like that. The pub, but we've got no pub, so that's only our thing in life we can watch.
Val Pashalis says the TV is an important source of entertainment for pensioners and families in the small town.
TV is important in Eidsvold because that's my favourite thing. And everybody here, it's their favourite thing. They've got nothing else here but their TV.
Eidsvold is about 400 kilometres northwest of Brisbane and has one of the highest proportions of Indigenous residents in Queensland. North Burnett Community Service CEO Yasmin Barber says TV plays a vital role in keeping the community connected.
So I think it's extremely important, particularly given our rural nature. We are a more isolated town. We don't have access to a lot of general services and activities. So I'm actually really concerned from a social isolation perspective. We've had a number of pensioners who've come to us and expressed distress about what they're going to be doing. They're concerned about what kind of news media they'll be able to access as well, which is something that I'm also really concerned about. And it's what kind of things they're going to be able to do at home. It really is, you know, for better or worse, this is their kind of social interaction and social engagement a lot of the time, and how they feel connected with the outside world.
The local council says residents will still be able to access free-to-air TV through a federal government service known as FAST. But Ms. Barber says the setup costs mean many in the community will go without TV altogether.
I just had a conversation with one of our local Sparkies, and he advised it's $800 straight up, and then for any additional TV it's a further $350 on top of that. So that is just out of reach for the vast majority of people in community.
She says poor internet and mobile coverage make the loss of TV reception all the more devastating.
The other thing that council and a lot of people will often say, oh, I'll just use the internet, or people can stream, they have access to the internet. So again, we already know in the North Burnett and particularly in Idsfold that the uptake of NBN and other internet sources is very low. It's very expensive. You can only get Telstra mobile coverage here, and that's patchy at best. So there's a whole range of compounding issues that really make this a significant issue for people and community members in the North Burnett.
And as Anne Johnson watches her final episode of Home and Away tonight, she says she's worried for the community that will no longer have TV as an escape from their day-to-day lives.
And that's the best thing, is having that way of breaking the monotony. And, yeah, I just can't even imagine what the fallout's going to be. You know, it's really upsetting. It's just, in this day and age, to me, it's just going back to dark old days.
That's Anne Johnson from Idsfold, ending that story by Pat Heaney. We've had a number of text messages on this point. Julie from Mount Garnet says the radio is more important than the TV. She couldn't live without it. Thank you, Julie. And another text saying closing down the TV is a good thing. It gets the families back together around the kitchen table. I've had a tap from David from Alligator Creek saying it's zero. I'm sorry about that, David, but he does say I'm a good Country Hour presenter. Thank you, David. It's news time now. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.